Welcome to Let's Talk. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners across the country where the program's broadcast, particularly the local traditional owners, the Jagera, Yagera, Turrbal and Yugrupul people, the Mananjali, Combermere, Noonuckle, Quandamooka and Yugambeer people. I'd also like to acknowledge elders, elders of the First Peoples of the land and elders of more recent arrivals. Welcome to each and every one of you. And welcome to all our listeners tuned in across the country via the National Indigenous Radio Service and across the world by the World Wide Web. Welcome to you. It's great to have your company. Well, another beautiful blue sky, sunshiny day. A little bit of rain last night. Just a shower or so, enough to wet the porch or the front deck and I'm out on the road and stuff. I was up walking the dog a bit before six. Didn't hear a thing, mind you, so there couldn't have been too much of it around. But good to see a little bit of moisture, just a little bit, a bit of a teaser. Bit of a teaser for Jamie Dunn, letting him know, because he's a man that loves the sunshine and blue sky, doesn't like rain. One of them sort of migloos, right? He uses the word, he knows. But, however, Jamie, we've got to have rain. You'll hear him talk about it. When it starts raining, you'll hear him talk about it. But some interesting stuff there this morning. The Queensland Murray Carnival, the Brekkie Show there with Jamie and Ian, Tony Curry on board, having a chat about the big Murray Carnival on the weekend after this weekend. Oh, what about that Facebook thing Jamie read out? That was a... It's hard to understand where what rock this bloke's been hiding under. He might have been out under Uluru hiding, writing things about the Burley, Sister Burley girls. Oh, no, we can't put them on in this venue. They're too heavy. They're carrying too much weight. What rock have you been hiding under, my friend? Anyway, some good discussion taking place there on the Brekkie Show with Jamie and Ian. Now we follow up with some culture, language, politics, First Nations issues. And to help me through it, to talk with me today about this, is Vince Coulthard, talking to me from down in South Australia. Vince is the chair of the Adnamutna Traditional Land Association. He's a language speaker for his mob and stuff. Very fortunate situation to be in, to be on your own country and be able to speak the language of your people, the language of that land that goes back tens of thousands of years. How deadly must that be? Vince, welcome to the program. How are you?
Yeah, good morning, Tiger. Yeah, I'm well.
Very good. Now, I forgot to say also that you are also the manager, the head honcho down there with Amiwara Media.
You've been around for a little while now.
You have.
Yeah.
We'll talk about the importance of that facility, that service, in our general discussion today about community-controlled First Nations agencies and organisations. But tell me your mob, your country.
My country extends from, pretty much the Flinders Ranges region of South Australia. It's more central South Australia, predominantly between the two lakes, Lake Torrens, Lake Frome, and just south of Lake Eyre.
All right. Yeah. And that's the Adnyamutna people, is it? Did I say it right?
Adnyamutna people. Yeah. Adnyamutna is a collective of a number of different small groups that have come together many, many years ago, but they speak the one language. Just slightly different dialects, but that's the nation, the Adnyamutna nation. Adnya is eels or rock people.
Okay.
Matana means a group.
Uh-huh. Now, your country there, you got, some plains country, lake country, mountain country? You got a bit of a mixture there, or what?
Yeah, a bit of mixture. We got, as I said, there's the two main lakes on either side of, one falls in within the boundaries, Lake Frome and Lake Torrens is on the sort of western region. But we have mountains, we have sand dunes, we have, you know, a nice contrasting environment. Arid lands plus, some bushland, even some round, particularly around Wilpena Pound, there's a high, it's a dense vegetation, almost a forest, a remote or arid forest, you could even call it.
Really?
Because it's a lot of grassland, a lot of thick vegetation. Yes, yeah, so it's a good contrasting environment.
Sounds lovely. Vince, I've had a few discussions about identity and what it means to First Nations people. And it's not only a thing for First Nations people, identity. I think identity is important for all human beings to be able to have a bit of an understanding of where they come from, who their forefathers were and what they did. Because that's what makes us now today in the 21st century, what's that saying? There's a little saying, I don't know, where the sum of all that goes before us, or the sum of those collective experiences of our ancestors or something. But what, in the last month or so, there has been discussions, public discussions on mainstream media particularly, and I've picked up on it on this program with a few different people, just to talk about identity, because it's a big thing. We struggle after some 220, 25, 26 years or so of colonisation since the invasion. We struggle with having these foreign terms of reference or mainstream terms of reference that require us to identify ourselves and then to pull out a form to prove or confirm our identity, the confirmation of Aboriginality form as it is known. So that's very much a part of our daily lives, this identity. What does identity mean to you as an Adnyamatna man?
Well, I mean, firstly, Tiger, I think identity is very important, particularly with the way that we are in today's society. Identity was important back prior to the colonisation as well. But because we move into other people's country today, I think it's very important. A lot of our people have grown up in off country, but when they, you know, it's really important to them to know where their belonging is. Belonging somewhere and having authority is another something to be, I guess, we need to learn a little bit about. And in the people coming back to country, they need to be able to respect the people that have continued to live on country and continue to practice their culture. Too often, it's people that sort of go away that comes back with the education and dominancy, I suppose, of trying to bring about society, bring about general society back into our communities. One of the other difficulties we have, Tiger, is that we certainly in areas that are semi-cultural areas, I guess you could call it, people try to pick and choose what part of the culture that they what's good for them today. I mean, culture, you know, our old practices are important, and there's something that we should try to hang on to. This is all part and parcel of identity. Is to be able to know that where we belong and know our place in society, in our communities. We have, as I said, Western influences that try to, people will use that to try and change our practices, which is really wrong. I mean, we really should not be doing that. We need to. I know that, and a lot of people will say that. Times have changed. We need to move on, but there's some things we need to. There's some things that can't be changed.
Yeah.
Biggest blackfellow law don't change.
That's right. Knowing our place. Yeah, go on, you go.
No, sorry.
Knowing our place, the identity, that connection to country, knowing our place, along with that comes responsibilities, comes
absolutely
rights.
Yeah.
In knowing our place and having that connection to country, to country, yeah, to place. And it needn't be a foreign concept for the recent arrivals if they were able to feel connected to country or to a part of the country. They would then be able to more easily take responsibility for the management and looking after the custodial sort of roles, wouldn't they?
Yeah, yeah. Firstly, this is like with like with anything, you move into a different area, you need to get orientated. And I say that when you move back into country, you need to get orientated. You need to know your connection. You need to know your affiliations with people. You need to research all this before you can, because there are some cultural practices there that you cannot, you just cannot talk to just anyone about. So you need to know all the laws of the land before you can actually get out and speak with authority.
Know the lay of the land, know the law of the land, yes.
Know the layout of the land, know the law of the land.
And law, Vince, in this case is L-A-W, not L-O-R-E. Too often, Vince, I hear our mob say, that's our law, L-O-R-E. They don't realise that L-O-R-E means fairy tales, it means myths, it means little gammon stories. That's L-O-R-E, folklore. We're talking about law, proper law, L-A-W. Is that correct? Is that what you're saying?
That's correct. Yeah, that's proper law. And what people would deem as L-O-R-E, I mean, I'd look at it as more like, there's something that's, you'd obviously discuss with kids, you know?
That's right.
But there's the relationship. It's all part and parcel of the law as in L-A-W. I mean, the kinship. You know, there are things that people cannot, or you, as one, an Aboriginal person cannot speak about in front of certain other community members, you know, or family members.
Yes.
You know, so there are that kind of things. And a lot of times when people come back in, they learn a little bit and then they become, you know,
Big authority,
but also they speak out of turn,
yeah,
and can create all kinds of problems.
You made a point earlier that sometimes people select little bit of that culture, and want to embrace that. That identity is about embracing the culture, the lot. You can't take a bit of this, bit of that. And we see that happen a lot within the mainstream society, where they might be in awe of Aboriginal art, say, you know, but fail to understand the relationship, how that artwork was created, or the relationship with that artwork within the culture of that particular mob. So they, and again, like you say, with some of our people that are just finding out that they have Aboriginal heritage in their country, in their blood, rather, or the heritage of First Nations people, a grandmother, a great-grandmother, or grandfather, somebody. And sometimes they in their keenness and emotional state or eagerness to and happiness to be, yes, First Nations, you know, we got something that means something to us. They can be a little overbearing or just jumping too far ahead. Take one step at a time. Take it easy, I suppose, is probably some good advice. Take it easy and learn as what you can and soak it up. And
soak
don't
it
just
up first, yeah,
soak
absolutely.
It up. Mm.
You know, absorb it all and be part of it and, you know, and start to live it and embrace it all.
Yeah.
Yeah. But also just the other thing with that, Tiger, is that you don't you, you I mean, it takes a long time before you become an expert. So don't step, you know, overstep the boundaries and say that you're, you know, some of us have lived it our, you know, entire life, 50, you know, 50, 60 years, and we're still not experts. We're still learning.
That's right.
And others, you know, you just can't come in and learn it all in, you know, 2 or 3 days.
Become the authority.
Or 2 or 3 months.
Yeah, yes.
Yeah.
The other situation that is quite challenging is people, I suppose, we people my colour, you're fine. No question about you being blackfella, being Adnya Mutna man, but they can see your First Nations man, your features, the colour of your skin and stuff like that. And then lighter skinned fella like me, and even lighter ones, tend to get questioned or denied in some cases, and sometimes by our own mob. Oh, no, you're not a proper blackfella, you know.
Yeah.
And things like this. But colour and features, really, that doesn't have a lot to do with identity, does it? You can still...
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, colours don't mean a thing.
Mm.
I mean, it's what's in you. You know, it's your soul. It's your...
That spirit.
It's your heart.
Mm. Mm.
It's what's in you that makes you, you know, an Aboriginal person.
And then you've got the mob. You've got the mob, the white fella mob. They've grown up in proper. You may know some. You may have experienced it where you got white fella mob that have grown up, went to school with you, or you, or their parents went to school with your parents. But and they know Adnya Mutna country as their home.
Yeah.
And you can, and they can be accepted. They've embraced. They understand. They've got the respect. They got some of the knowledge, some of the history of country. They've established relationships. They could, you know, they can be identifying and saying, "Yeah, we've been adopted by this mob. We're part of this land. This land's part of us."
Yeah,
yeah.
They feel for it. They even there's a lot of fair skinned people around that can talk language better than some of the dark skinned people.
Yeah,
you know, so the colour doesn't mean a thing. It's what's in your heart and where you belong and the knowledge that you have of your people.
Now, yeah, go on.
Yeah, no.
I want to move on. Well, it's important, I suppose, for people across the board, be they recent arrivals, mainstream mob, to know their mob, know where they come from. And like I've said before, even if they've come out, their forefathers have come out as convicts or the slave masters on some of those boats that came out from England in the early days. It doesn't much matter, but I think it's important that they know, that they can trace back to help understand maybe some of their traits, some of the characteristics or values that they carry.
Well, there's a little bit of that in my own family. My partner's father came out from Italy. He came out here and he is building the railway line from South Australia across to WA. He's in part of that when the Italians were sent out on the lines to build the Trans-Australian Railways.
All right.
And he met up with my mother-in-law, and they obviously had family. He is out here for 50 years before he went back to his own country for a visit, and we went. My wife went over with him, and my daughter went back with him for the first time, for their first time, but all his first time since he'd been out here.
When did they go back? What year was this?
Back in 1999, they went over there, and I went over just a little about a week later. And it is absolutely amazing to see the you know, after being away for that long, that people embraced him then and the family, and including myself, for that matter, the way that his family that he hadn't seen for 50 years has embraced us, you know. I mean, and the culture, their culture is very much alive, and our similarities to, you know, Aboriginal cultures here in Australia.
All right, some of the values and like looking after their old people and
absolutely the caring for people and and the respect and the, you know, the people that have authority. I mean, they're all, you know, the elderly people being put on, you know,
being valued.
Put on, being valued, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just amazing. It really opened my eyes. My visit to Europe was, you know, I kept seeing Australia, that a lot of our mob here, we live across this continent with all these different, all our different languages, and, you know, like very much like the Europeans. You know, they all speak in different languages, but and they live on, you know, basically on one continent. But you can catch a train, you travel through two or three countries in, you know, overnight. Sort of.
Yeah, overnight. That's right. Yeah. Yes. No, yeah. It is amazing, and it is very similar to our country, yeah, and our mob.
Unreal.
Yes.
But I mean, you know, I think we certainly. I mean, one of the other things that I did find over there. Those people respected Australian Aborigines, you know, or Aboriginal people from this country. You tell them that, yeah, or they'll come up and ask you, are you Australian Aborigine or Australian Aboriginal person? And, you know, and they just, I mean, they just welcome you with open arms.
Yeah.
The French people, the you know, the Spanish people, the, you know, I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Yes, no, there is that that respect and wanting to learn more about our mob. It's stronger overseas and with international communities than it is in our own country, which is sad. But I think, you know, we keep on talking and there are more, there's a growing, the numbers are growing of the settler society that are realising the value of First Nations people. I mean, Vince, it's not all that long ago that we ran this country, you know, that our women and children walked safely, walked free of fear. It's not all that long ago, and we've got a lot to offer in this society.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you did mention it was 230, 200 some odd years in general. I mean, here in South Australia, it's probably, it's certainly less than that.
Mm.
But, I mean, and people, non-Aboriginal people come to my area, really at the, in the late 1800s, you know, some of my people seen non-Aboriginal people for the first time. I remember my dad telling me that his grandfather told him that, you know, he is really shocked with when he's seen a non-Aboriginal person because his skin was light. He thought it was a ghost.
Yeah.
This is my dad's grandfather, you know, and so it's not all that long ago.
It isn't all that long ago. It's a good point you make because country like yours and like your dad and his parents and grandparents, that white man never got out there till almost 100 years after hitting the East Coast, you know, Sydney and places like that, yeah.
Yeah, and I can understand the impact that they would have had on, you know, certainly the East Coasters, because the impact that they had on our people since coming in, that's just a little over 100 years, you know, coming to my country, and they made a lot of changes and caused a lot of, you know, there's been, I mean, a lot of good has happened too.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, I mean, let's face it, I mean, today we live in houses and drive motor cars and stuff, so they brought this stuff in, but there's been a lot of environmental damage. There's been a lot of cultural damage, in some places, loss of identity as you talk, Tiger, you know, language and you know, understanding kinship and understanding association with country and not having, you know, by not having connection, strong connection to country, because they've changed the countryside, you know.
And drew up new boundaries and just created South Australia and Victoria and Queensland and New South Wales and what have you,
These borders.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Let's take a break for a song. We've got a First Nations man by the name of Frankie Yammer singing a song called Black Man's Crying. My guest today is Vince Coulthard. He is the chairperson of the Adnyamatna people, Adnyamatna traditional land owners down there in South Australia. My guest is Vince Coulthard, chairperson of the Adnyamatna traditional owners, traditional land association down there in South Australia. Vince, I want to talk about community-controlled organisations. A number of communities or a number of organisations are approaching some 40 years of existence, of being around. The health services started out some, I think it was Sydney, they had their 40th anniversary earlier this year or late last year. So part of our development, part of our development in community as First Nations people was identifying the failings of the mainstream system, health, housing, legal, the justice area, childcare, and our mob got mobilised, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane. I recall a lot of the meetings in 70, 71, 72 and so on and so forth, where our people mobilised and organised, like a health service, for example, approaching white collar doctors and saying, can you come in and volunteer a couple of hours a week? We don't feel we're being treated right within the hospitals and within the mainstream health system. Housing companies being set up because I experienced some of the most racist experiences in my time in those early 70s trying to get a house, and they found out you was a black fella, that was it. Oh, no, that house is gone. So our mob saw the gap, saw the problems, and then mobilised and organised and set up these community-controlled organisations. Today, they are networks, national networks across the country, and you would probably frequent one or two of these organisations, like your local community health service or something similar. Your radio station that you manage is a community-controlled agency, and the media was established only from the, I think, 80s. 80 onwards, so that's only 30 years or so ago, when our people saw the gaps in the media, the misrepresentation, the bias, the discriminatory views, racist and ignorance being presented. And one of the most recent well-known cases is the Bolt case. So community control, Vince, what does it mean to you? What do you see when you look around you and see some of these growing tentacles that have gone across the country and spread from the likes of Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, spread from the East Coast right across the country in the likes of community health services, but and right through to media, community radio stations. What are your thoughts?
Well, firstly, Tiger, I mean, today there isn't as many community control organisations, certainly in my region, that existed 20 years ago. Demise of ATSIC, the community control organisations have diminished. Now,
been consumed, closed down, or taken over by another organisation, or what? Which way?
Well, I mean, a bit of everything. Some have been closed down completely. Others have taken over by mainstream. Their functions and you know, they say that the government's move was that this is going to be providing a better service, but the reality is it's not. I mean, you know, the services that have taken on these responsibilities, non-Aboriginal people making decisions.
So you're saying that's a backward step. I mean, the reason these community-controlled organisations were set up, Vince, as we all know, was because of the failings of the mainstream systems. So when you say they'd been set up and then some of them just shut down and replaced by white fella services, government services, that's a backward step, I take it.
Yeah, absolutely. It is a backward step. I think the whole thing was a move from the government system to pull back black fellas, you know, because they didn't want us controlling our own destiny.
Hmm.
You know, it's one step forward, two step back. And you know, this is certainly the case here in my region. and certainly in South Australia, I think it's happening right across the whole nation. I mean, you only got to look at the stuff that's happening up in the territory, the intervention stuff. I mean, how people don't determine their own destiny now. I mean, the people have lost control.
Your region? Do you live in Port Augusta?
I live in Port Augusta, but throughout my tribal lands, traditional lands, that's just really only half an hour from where I currently live. So, so I'm on country a lot, but, I can be on country in a very short time.
Yes, yes. Mm. So the Northern Territory intervention, do you see an impact on your country, on your lands? Are there people coming across? And then there's even the APY lands that's been in the media a little bit, where there's some upheavals, some government not recognising the needs. And then I think it might have been Port Augusta, where the mayor, there was some issues where some of the mob from APY lands were coming down to, was it Port Augusta?
And they
weren't real happy with that, and they'd come down for health reasons or to escape from intervention or something, or whatever it might be. But there were some issues there where First Nations people were coming into Port Augusta and upsetting some of the establishment, like the mayor and people.
Yeah, that's been happening, not so much in recent times, but a few years back there was. But let me go back. Port Augusta is a very important place for South Australians. I mean, people would come here particularly from the north, would travel down this way during the summer months, and it's something that's been happening for hundreds of years. So people, it's an old tradition that would Port Augusta would before Port Augusta was even built here, Amiwara used to attract people from all around the sort of northern region for ceremonial purposes, for trade, for all kinds of reasons.
Mm.
Now, that creates, when people come in here, they because Port Augusta is a very, it's a small city, I suppose, but there's a lot of bushlands very close by, and people, come in and, erect their dwellings, like wurleys and whatever, live out in the sand hills. This has created a problem. It's an image thing for the mayor and city council.
So you're saying there's a history, there's a tradition, this is part of the culture that goes back hundreds of years, thousands of years, where
yes.
People, your mob and other and neighbours further to the north, moved around. They moved south. And now there just happens to be a concrete jungle. It hasn't disrupted this practice with some of the mob. They still move south.
They still do it, yeah.
It's good that you explain that point, because that's something that's not, that hasn't been a focus or even gets a mention. That some of this business that happens today, like exactly that, the move around country, has been happening for tens of thousands of years by people of those same countries.
Yeah, exactly. And the local First Nations people, those ceremonial meeting or greetings here, or meetings here in Port Augusta, long before Port Augusta was established. So these people would come in from all parts. Port Augusta's old crossroad, originally, as part of the trade. It's on the trading route.
Yeah.
So people coming up from Victoria, people, or the down through the Adelaide Plains area, coming up into this part of the world, and then through York and Eyre Peninsula, even moving from the west across to Port Augusta. So I mean, it's always been a traditional practice, but it became a real issue. With the authorities in well, not so much recent time, but But it was an image thing because I was trying to build the image of Port Augusta, change, as they say, for the better, and having Aboriginal people come and live in the outskirts of Port Augusta was not a good image.
Bit of an eyesore for them.
Yeah, bit of an eyesore for them.
What do you think could be done here, Vince? What's been the discussion, the dialogue between maybe your mob and the authorities, the mayor and people like that? Because reading on the mayor's views in the mainstream media was a woman, I think, and she wasn't very friendly or understanding of issues. All she could see was it's unsightly, was my interpretation of how she felt, and she was saying it in other words, but this wasn't good. What wasn't good for the image of Port Augusta? It's unsightly and stuff like that. What has been happening as far as dialogue and engagement to try and resolve this?
Well, one of the things that has happened, and just taking the heat off a bit, they built the city council and the Aboriginal community built a little sort of tent, you could call it a tent.
What, a camping ground type
camp, thing? Campground for people that's moving into Port Augusta.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that...
that works?
It's working.
It's got people facilities, coming, like where they get water and things, showers and toilets and all that, the amenities, yeah?
Yeah, they've got showers and, you know, and a mess area. And
okay, people can have their common kitchen and stuff, yeah? Yeah.
Yeah, so it's working. But one of the other things that has happened is they created this community engagement group where the three tiers of government are involved with it, and holding each, you know, as well as the community, they're able to hold each other responsible, you know, to move ahead. Now, that's, as I understand, that group's been meeting on a regular basis. I've been to a couple of their meetings. They're doing some good planning, and I think there's a lot of good can come out of it. It's just, you know, having the right people making, driving it, and I think that is the case at the moment.
Very good.
So there's some positives happening, and, you know, this was... you know, I mean, a place like Port Augusta needs that because it's had too much downers in the past. I mean we've the radio station is working very hard to change, bring about awareness in, you know, some cultural awareness. I mean, just like pretty much like we're talking now, talk about language, the importance of language, the importance of, you know, cultural practices. These people will continue to come to Port Augusta. They have done so for thousands of years and they'll continue to come.
So the radio station is important to try and get that word out.
Get the message out, yeah.
You have a lot of the mainstream mob tuning into the station, hearing these discussions.
Well, one of the things that, being a small country city, I suppose, you know, like a small country town, country music attracts people.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
And it's really good to lob some of those messages in there. The importance of culture, the importance of language, and, you know, and I think the message is getting out. We've got a good wide range of listening audience, and for instance, you can hop in a cab here in Port Augusta and they listen to Dummy Warra.
That's the way to go. You got them. Good one.
Yeah.
That's great.
So there's good happening.
Yeah.
Port Augusta has changed in recent times. Has changed. I mean, the old Slim Dusty song there, Life in Port Augusta Never Changed. Remember that one?
Yeah.
I mean, it's... And that is a bit of a wake-up call to the old me. I think she really hated that song. And she wouldn't even let old Slim Dusty come and perform here.
Really?
Mm. After he released that.
I didn't like it at all.
Yeah.
Really, eh?
Yeah. Anyway, I mean, that's life in Port Augusta.
Yeah, for sure. Vince, the Northern Territory intervention, how has that sort of impacted some spillover, some people wanting to get away, come down south to Port Augusta? Has there been any of that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, that's you know, brought people down here in different times of the year. I mean, because, and then into Adelaide, that's created some problems in Adelaide, where people are moving down from, you know, Central Australia and, you know, sort of that region. And people, you know, there is overflow of people coming out of territory because of the intervention. Not so, I mean, with this camp here now, it serves them well, the ones that come into there, and obviously people move through the south into Adelaide. I think it does create a little bit of problem in Adelaide because they haven't got the kind of this kind of camp set up for people moving into Adelaide.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the area that I guess it's more of, have an effect on is, you know, like around the AP lands. I mean, you know, a lot of the people from across the border come into AP lands for creating, you know, it does put a lot of pressure on local people.
Do you think then that camping area type thing, is that something that could be duplicated or could be developed in other areas across the country, so that our mob are able to just turn up with a bit of canvas, with a tent or whatever? Do you think that's something that is of value and can work and alleviate some of the problems? If you'd like to make a call, I am unable to get hold of Vince. He's dropped out. 3892 0188, if you would like. Feel free. 3892 0188. I'm back tomorrow, Thursday, for Let's Talk. Make sure you join us. You have a great day.